Welcome to the Holistic Health Podcast, where we delve into topics that bridge wellness and science for the skin, gut, mind, body, and soul. This podcast is brought to you by Gvome, where we believe that each of us has a unique ecosystem and path to reach our full vitality.
I'm your host, Dr. Raja Sivamani, an integrative physician and an Ayurvedic practitioner. Gvome is the notion that our jiva, the Sanskrit word for vitality and the essence of life, merges with our many ecosystems that compose our biome to form our unique Gvome. This podcast is meant for educational and informational purposes only. None of the information presented here are a substitute for professional medical care, and this podcast does not constitute medical advice. If you have a medical concern, please consult with your physician. Hi, everyone. Today, we are talking about food sensitivity and food allergy and food sensitivity testing. So this is a pretty hot area, wouldn't you say, Ashley?
Oh, yes. A big topic to discuss.
Yeah. I mean, I think almost everybody that's coming in to see me in the skin world is asking about food sensitivity. But, you know, we have a specialist here who goes much beyond skin and talks about general health. And he is a pediatric allergist. This is Dr. Neil Jain. He has a special interest in food allergy and food sensitivity testing. He's got extensive training and he sees the little kiddos. But, you know, just being an allergist, he's going to know a lot of stuff about when to test, when not to test. We're hoping you'll help us see clear through these muddy waters, Neil.
Yeah, well, I'll do my best. So as mentioned, I'm an allergist in Phoenix. I trained as a pediatrician initially. I do see both adults and kids now. And I've had the good fortune of working with a lot of people who have researched the area of food allergy and being involved in a lot of clinical research relating to a lot of different conditions. And I think one of the neat things about this field and about allergy and immunology is that we have to accept that we don't know what we don't know. And there's still a lot to learn, but I'll do my best to share what we do know and what we're learning and what direction I think things are going.
That'd be awesome. So let me kick it off by asking you, how do you think about food allergies and sensitivity? How is it defined? And when do you even think of, hey, I should start thinking about testing for it?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, when you think about food sensitivity, food allergy, I think they fall under the umbrella of adverse reactions to foods, right? So people will come in and they'll say, you know, I eat these foods and I don't feel well when I eat these foods, or I eat in general and I don't feel well. And that may be manifest by gastrointestinal complaints. It could be manifest by mucus in the back of their throat. It could be manifest by skin complaints, right? And so you have to think about, okay, when people are describing these symptoms, is this a seem to be an immunological response to a food, which is how you would define an allergy, is an adverse immunological response to a food versus a sensitivity or versus a pharmacologic effect of foods, right? So if you eat a lot of chocolate, there are different chemicals in chocolate that can have a pharmacological effect on you. And some people are more prone to those than others. There's caffeine in it. And if you're sensitive to caffeine, you might have more symptoms from that. You might have symptoms from excess sugar. And so you have to think about, when you think about sensitivity, it involves some of these things. And I think when people think about it, they oftentimes will experience some of these symptoms. And sometimes they are related to an immunological effect and sometimes they're not. And that's one of the challenges that we have when we're trying to tease through whether people are having, you know, these adverse reactions to foods.
So then I guess that really brings up an interesting point, because these reactions can have a varied presentation or varied causes. How do you think about testing then? How do you go about seeing if a particular food's involved?
Yeah. So, I mean, for us, you know, training as an allergist, you know, the first thing that we were taught when it came to allergies and food allergies, which, you know, I think this is an evolving topic as well. And I'll give an example in a moment. But we were always taught that, you know, if someone is having a true allergy to a food, it should be timely, it should be reproducible, consistent, and have a distinct pattern of symptoms. And that certainly pertains to what we see with what are called IgE-mediated food allergies, where people are, for example, allergic to peanut or tree nuts or eggs or shellfish, where they ingest a food and immediately experience symptoms, typically within minutes to 1 to 2 hours at the latest, itchy mouth, throat, gastrointestinal upset, hives, swelling, etc. And we know a lot about the manifestations, the immunological processes that are involved. But as I said, this is an evolving field, and we're beginning to understand that there are conditions that we're learning about where it may not be so clear cut. and where testing for the antibody called IgE, which is the classic sort of allergic, what we know call a type 1 hypersensitivity reaction, testing for IgE may not necessarily be the end-all be-all for identifying whether people are allergic. And a classic example of this is that we're learning about a group of conditions that can manifest in a much different fashion, with people having more vague gastrointestinal symptoms, gas, bloating, abdominal discomfort, sometimes loose stool, sometimes constipation, just not feeling well after they eat foods. And it turns out that there is a group of conditions called eosinophilic gastroenteropathies, where we do, if you look hard enough, find actual pathology in the gastrointestinal tract, and where our testing may have limitations and not be able to identify the patient's disease or what foods are causing problems. And in that scenario, or those kinds of scenarios, it gets to be quite a bit harder. And I would say that we're still learning about how we identify those kinds of allergies.
You mentioned looking for IgE for a true allergy. And now I know there's some talk about IgG, and I'm curious to know if you test for any other antibodies and what your experience is with IgG, or if you test that at all.
Yeah, so, you know, this is, I think, also an area that's hot. And certainly as an allergist, we see a lot of people who come into our office with test results that they've received either from their primary care doctors or from, again, naturopaths or functional medicine physicians. And, you know, honestly, there's a lot of debate about this. The hard part with IgG4 testing, which is typically what's done, and sometimes IgA testing, is that we really don't know if when you produce IgG4 in particular, or IgA, if that's actually an abnormal response to a food. So it turns out that if you actually think about our body and how our body's immune system works, it's not as simple as we see something foreign and bad and we react to it, and we see things that are foreign and not bad and we don't react to it. In fact, it's far more complicated than that. Our body's immune system and the epithelium, so the lining of our body, whether it's our skin, our gastrointestinal tract, or our respiratory tract, is constantly sampling the environment. And as you can imagine, we're sampling all kinds of things. We sample for bacteria, we sample for viruses, we sample different proteins, and those can be pollens, they can be foods, there can be molds. There's all kinds of things that are foreign to us that our body experiences. Our immune system doesn't simply say, when it sees things that are not harmful, oh, I see you and I'm not going to do anything. It is actually an active process with everything we're exposed to. So you may see something completely benign, and in fact, your body says, okay, I see you, I recognize you, and it acts upon that recognition. And so we know that for the case of IgG4, it actually is signaled, it's an antibody that's produced by a group of immune cells that are what are called, well, B cells, but they're stimulated by a different group of immune cells called T regulatory cells. And these cells are really important in telling our body how to use its brakes. And I like to think of the immune system as having sort of an accelerator and having brakes. And this part of your immune system is an important part of your brakes. An interesting finding is that we're seeing that we actually have some treatments for people that have true food allergies, like peanut allergies or egg allergy or that kind of thing. And when we're going through the process of treating these patients for their food allergies, we actually stimulate the production of IgG4. And we think that that IgG4 is actually protective, not harmful. And this throws this whole sort of idea of this food sensitivity testing on its ear, because it makes you question, okay, if this is really just a picture of your immune system sampling things, what does that testing mean? I typically tell patients, I don't really know what it means. And I honestly don't know what the IgA testing means in isolation, especially as we learn more about how our immune system functions and the role of these antibodies and what they may actually signal.
Neil, this is such an interesting area because I get questions about food allergies all the time, and this has been a challenge. What do you think about these commercial tests that are available? You know, you go into the Walmarts or the Targets and you see them on the shelf and it says, you know, find out your food sensitivities, with this test kit. You know, they're widely prevalent. I see them coming up on my Facebook feeds many times now. I don't know how it figured out that I went and looked at it while, like, at one of these department stores, and it's on my Facebook feed. I mean, oh my God, what the heck is going on?
But I know.
Anyway, regardless, what do you think about those testing?
There's all of this stuff out there, right? I mean, there's eating for your blood type. There's, you know, food testing that you can get, as you mentioned, at Target or Walmart. There's genetic testing that says, okay, look, I can tell you which foods you should or shouldn't eat. And I would say this, one, we don't know what we don't know. But at the same time, I would say we don't know what we don't know. And so when people are saying we do know and that this testing does give you this answer, it makes me quite skeptical. And I will say that we're learning more, again, about some of these conditions. A lot of people that have been diagnosed with irritable bowel syndrome, or, you know, where we just don't know what's going on, where I think the science is starting to catch up a little bit, where we're being able to identify that there is, in fact, pathology present. And that pathology may be driven, you know, at a fundamental level by, you know, disruption of our normal symbiosis with good bacteria and bad bacteria taking over and those kinds of things. But I hesitate to suggest that these tests are, in fact, an answer. And I'll say that I see as many people coming in saying they've followed the advice of these tests and found benefit, as I do see people saying that they've seen these tests, tried to do the diets, and not seen benefit. And so without sort of validated trials to say, okay, we're going to do these tests in a group of patients that have this group of symptoms, and we're going to randomly tell people to do this versus some other dummy diet and see if people actually do better, which has not been done, it's hard for me to really advocate for the use of those tests.
Instead of those tests, a lot of people say that perhaps an elimination diet is a gold standard to figure out what their quote-unquote sensitivities are. I'm curious what your experience is with that.
Yeah, I would certainly say that's a better way to go. And that's typically what I tell people to do. And I, you know, I've joked with Raja in the past that, look, we're monkeys, right? So, you know, we are animals fundamentally. And fundamentally, if you look at the evolution of humans as animals, we didn't start eating the diet that we've been eating in our present state, you know, until maybe a couple thousand years ago. We're probably not supposed to eat a lot of the stuff that we eat. And so I always tell people, look, go back to what we are supposed to eat first and foremost, which is going to include a lot more fruits, a lot more vegetables, a lot more fiber, a lot more of the things that, you know, make us feel good and make us healthy. And I also tell people that a lot of the symptoms that we might experience, gastrointestinal or otherwise, sometimes are a sign of our general unhealthiness, right? And so although our diet is a huge part of our well-being and our health, so are things like sleep and exercise and rest and control of stress and all of those other things that we've sort of thrown on ourselves as we've sort of come into the 21st century that are disrupting, I think, the way that we were meant, quote unquote, to live.
I love what you're touching upon here, Neil. So it brings a new question to my mind. As an allergist, you probably have to look at whether something's a sensitivity or an allergy all the time. What's the role of stress and lack of sleep in priming your body to react more? Is that a real thing that you've noticed in the clinic?
Yeah. So, I mean, certainly, and there's all kinds of data, regardless of what, you know, disease state you look at, whether it's cancer or hypertension or diabetes or asthma, any of these kinds of things. If you look at stress and sleep, there's actually some real good scientific literature saying that they do affect outcomes significantly and the severity of disease significantly. You know, our bodies can heal themselves if we allow them to heal themselves and act in the way that they're supposed to act. And, you know, touching back on that elimination diet, I definitely tell people, you know, going through the process of an elimination diet can be really helpful. And if you're going to start somewhere, go back to the basics of what we're supposed to eat, which is, again, those fruits, vegetables, lean meats, et cetera. And go back to the basics of shutting down your devices and not looking at the TV screens and the computers. Listen to this podcast, of course, but don't do those things that are maladaptive to us, and you'll start to feel better. I challenge people to do this for a month and to keep a food diary and to pay attention to the things that make them feel good and the things that make them feel bad. And invariably, things that make us feel bad are oftentimes the processed foods and the wheat and the gluten and the dairy, which we're not probably supposed to have as much of as we have. And coincidentally, you know, you do the IgG4 testing, and those are the same things that come up positive. Why do those come up positive? Because those are common foods that we eat in a Western diet, and they're reflected by your immune system saying, hey, I see this in your diet. And so in many cases, people will experience benefit from trying to avoid those things, because those are probably things that we're not supposed to eat a lot of in the first place.
You know, I want to jump in on that one. I think, because I wanted to ask you about the G word, gluten, and, you know, what your opinion was on that. But before you get into that, I did want to point out that this kind of literature is there in the psoriasis area. I can just speak to that really quick. In psoriasis, they've shown that if you do the IgG testing, just like you're saying, and it comes up positive for gluten, in folks with psoriasis that don't have overt celiac disease, like you're saying, it doesn't mean they have a sensitivity to gluten necessarily, but those people that come up positive, if they eliminate gluten, it's been shown that their psoriasis improves. And it was a series of studies done actually over a decade ago that looked at this. But like you're saying, you know, perhaps the reason for that is that your body is just saying, I see you, you're eating this food. And then when you eliminate it, maybe you're not eating the processed foods as much. And like you say, I guess, you know, cavemen didn't have caveman microwave dinners back in the day.
You know, it gets to be a really interesting sort of a thread that you can go down. Because if you think about it, when you eat gluten and we eat these processed foods, you know, whether it's dairy or gluten or other sorts of things that, again, are not high in fiber and don't, I think, really jive all that well with our GI tract. And from a nutritional standpoint, you're also changing rather significantly the gut flora. And what we are learning is that our gut flora is an immense conditioner of our immune system in our GI tract. And we have a very active immune system in our GI tract with the ability to influence the rest of our immune system in our body. And so the reason that we may be seeing improvement when you cut these things and you go to more sort of either plant-based diet or more high-fiber diet and healthier foods is that you may be actually influencing the immune system in our gut through, you know, a change in the bacteria that live in our gut. That may be very positive for us. And so I always tell people when they come in with these questions, you know, no, you're not crazy by thinking that this is potentially causing you problems. And I'm not going to tell you that. I don't know that I completely buy the test 100%, but there may be something to changing your diet and avoiding these foods for that reason.
Well, I think it's so refreshing to hear you say this, because I've wondered a lot about, you know, how do I wrap my head around these tests and whatnot. So when you're thinking about conditions where you do see a food sensitivity or allergy per se playing a role, what are some of the conditions that you see where you see a connection?
Yeah, I mean, it can be broad. And, you know, I mean, it can range from things like behavior and what are classically described as psychological conditions to things that are, I think, more easy to, you know, connect the dots, whether it be, you know, again, irritable bowel syndrome, inflammatory bowel disease, many of those different kinds of conditions. And again, I would say similarly, psoriasis, eczema, there's been a lot sort of written, and I think we are understanding more and more about this. And so I don't want to say that foods don't play a role, because I think they actually do. It's just a matter of us understanding in what way do we identify them. But I would say that in many of these conditions, diet can play a role. And it comes back to us, you know, again, being healthy animals.
How did you get into this area, Neil? Is this something that you learned a lot about during your pediatrics residency or in your fellowship training in allergy? Or is this something that you've picked up along the way since then?
Yeah, I would say it's sort of a combination. You know, I had a great mentor in Denver, National Jewish and Children's Hospital of Colorado, by the name of Dan Atkins, who is really a true gentleman in how he would approach patients who would come in with many of these same kinds of questions, and taught us well about, you know, how to identify true food allergies and what we did know and what we didn't know. And I think along the way, you know, this really is the practice of medicine and the art of medicine. And so you learn from your patients. And, you know, I have always taken the approach that we certainly don't know everything there is to know. And our immune systems, I feel, are like space. There's this constant exploration and understanding. And once we learn one thing, it opens up a whole other can of worms, right? And so, you know, I think through a lot of clinical research and sort of observation and sort of seeing where things are going, you know, as soon as we feel as though we might have our finger on something and understand something, a whole new sort of set of circumstances arises. And so it's led to me being open more to this. And I think I've just had a fascination about, you know, the why for a long time. I think really what we're learning is that we live in symbiosis with the world around us. And I think we're sort of messing that up in a large way and messing ourselves up. You know, as someone who's an environmentalist, a naturalist with a strong history in biology and ecology, I think this is all sort of coming together for me, and it's fascinating.
So working with kiddos, I'm kind of curious, as far as food sensitivity and food allergies go, what you see in children that may differ from adult populations?
Yeah, I mean, I think the challenge in kids is that they can't necessarily describe their symptoms, right? And so they'll come in and the parents will say, well, I know something's wrong, you know, and their behavior's off, they're not acting well, and I think something's wrong with their gut, or I think something is wrong, but I just can't put my finger on it. I think that's one of the biggest challenges. I mean, they can't tell you that a food is causing their symptoms. And so it can be harder to sort of follow an elimination diet because they may not be able to guide you. And they may manifest with, you know, simply behavioral changes. And it's easy, I think, for many doctors, MDs, you know, to sort of like blow these patients off without really trying to get at, you know, what could be going on. That's, I think, the biggest challenge is, again, accepting that we don't know what we don't know, and that simply because we don't know doesn't mean there's not something wrong, right? That there could be something wrong.
So, Neil, you know, when it comes to kids, or even if it's adults doing elimination diets or whatnot, you know, one of the concerns is that they eliminate everything. And now you have a child that's going to become malnutritioned or at least nutritionally deficient in some way, shape, or form. How do you talk through parents on if they're going to do an elimination diet, or even a person that's going to do an elimination diet? Is there a stepwise approach that you take? Because I'm sure this comes up in conversation for you often.
Yeah. And, you know, I've certainly seen, unfortunately, the ramifications and how this can sort of spiral in many instances, especially for where parents do have a lot of food anxiety or kids have food anxiety. And so, you know, I think you just have to be careful in the advice you give to your patients about how to approach this. And I tell them, look, first cut out the processed foods, cut out the refined foods, the refined starches, those kinds of things, and go to sort of more of a whole food diet initially. And then if you're going to cut things out, you do it in a stepwise approach. If there are foods that are truly causing an issue, you know, from a scientific standpoint, it seems as though there are a few foods that are more likely to cause problems than others, and they tend to be those foods that we find in processed forms. So start there. And if you're starting to see that your child is certainly not thriving, gaining weight, growing, then I think you have to sort of stop and say, okay, we need to look at other things. And those other things may be finding a gastroenterologist who sort of is truly willing to listen and help find an answer, or an allergist who's going to try to find an answer to see if there is something else truly pathologically wrong that might provide some insight.
Now, in Arizona, you have a rich community of practitioners around you. How do you work with folks that are outside of the traditional conventional medical forms? So if you're thinking about traditional Chinese medicine or an acupuncturist, or if you're talking about naturopathic doctors that are in the area, how do you work with them?
I try to have an open conversation and communication, and I encourage my patients, like I try to give my patients my cell phone, and I say, hey, if they've got questions and they want to chat, I'm more than happy to talk to them, because I think that we all do better when we collaborate and talk through things and are on the same page and trying to, you know, row in the same direction. So that's really what I try to do, is to just speak with my patients and be open and say, look, you know, I'm going to be honest, I don't know everything, and I'm not going to pretend like I do. And I think that anytime someone pretends like they really do know everything, you should be skeptical about it.
Yeah, no kidding. 100% agree.
You know, and then we have a conversation and say, let's, you know, what are our goals? How are we going to get there? And let's put together a roadmap as best we can with information we have, and let's work together to try to achieve those goals.
Well, Neil, this has been an awesome conversation. I'd love to hear more about what you're up to at your practice. So can you tell us a little bit about your practice? What kind of people do you see? And can you talk about the clinical research that you're doing?
Yeah. So as I said, I'm a relatively busy practicing allergist, but I do get bored in practice. So I do a lot of research. You know, I see both kids and adults. I think one of the neatest things we're seeing now is sort of this emergence of treatment for patients that have IgE mediated, you know, sort of the anaphylactic type of food allergy, where we're actually able to provide, in many cases, a cure for the younger kids who are allergic to things like peanut and eggs and milk, who may show signs that they're not going to outgrow it naturally. So that's, I think, one of the really neat things that we're doing. And there's a lot of research and interesting data being generated relating to that. And then on the research side, you know, we're actually involved with some startup companies, including an interesting one that's developing a drug for people that have this group of eosinophilic gastroenteropathies. But also they're showing, again, there's a large percentage of these patients that have irritable bowel syndrome that may in fact have pathology but just the pathologists haven't known how to find it. So we're doing some research with them, looking at some patient-reported outcomes, and potentially identifying patients that have pathology that was underrecognized and trying to find some solutions and a treatment option for them. So that's really been fun and exciting for me, because for a long time, we just didn't have anything for these people.
Well, Neil, if people wanted to find you, how can they find you?
I'm not the best. I need to be better about my social media. We do have a Facebook page. I've got an Instagram page for Arcadia Allergy and Asthma and Santana Allergy and Asthma, the same clinic, just different names, different locations. So if you look us up on the web, it's Santan, S-A-N-T-A-N, allergy.com, or Arcadia, A-R-C-A-D-I-A, allergy.com. And yeah, I've got Facebook pages, and I'm happy to help in any way I can.
Love the time. Love speaking to you. And Neil, we really appreciate your expertise, because this really is an area I think is trending like crazy.
Absolutely.
So thanks for giving us a little bit better idea of what can do to approach it.
Oh, I appreciate the opportunity, and I appreciate both of you asking such great questions, and look forward to chatting more in the future.
This is the Holistic Health Podcast, brought to you by Gvome, where we believe that cultivating a healthy ecosystem unique to you is important to living vital and living well. Don't forget to like, rate, and subscribe to our channel, and be sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook, and visit us at gvome.com. Check out our membership options to take your health to the next level.